Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
Lyme disease affects millions of people throughout the world. In fact, here in the United States, it's estimated that it affects approximately 100,000 Americans. And it also occurs among one out of every 365 Black or African American births. It's awful, and it's something that touches so many people. And if you didn't know, now you will. September is actually Sickle Cell Awareness Month, and we wanted to talk a little bit more about this, understand it a little bit more, but also the importance of blood donations. So for that, we have Dr. F. Bernadette West here, who is the Regional Medical Director for the American Red Cross in Connecticut. Good morning, Dr. Wes, thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So I know donors are needed every single day for all types of patients, and that includes people with sickle cell disease. During this awareness month, the Red Cross is reminding people that blood transfusions are often very critical to pain management for people who have sickle cell. Could you explain that a little bit?
Yes. People with sickle cell disease require frequent blood transfusions throughout their lifetime to treat the many complications of their disease because their blood sickles and it's not the right shape to go through capillaries well and to deliver oxygen well. And so they can receive blood from healthy donors, and that takes away a lot of the symptoms of their disease along with other medications they may use. So people with these chronic transfusions or routine exchanges require a lot of blood during a year, some maybe over 100 units per year, and that can make finding compatible blood difficult. And we know that people of similar racial or ethnic backgrounds are more likely to have similar red cell phenotypes or the red cell signature on the red cells versus those of different backgrounds. So as you stated, with 100,000 people or so living with sickle cell disease right now in the U.S., it's helpful and important to enrich the diversity of our donor base to increase the chances of finding appropriately matched blood for these patients.
Dr. West, do you mind backing up for just a second? I think a lot of people have heard of sickle cell, but maybe they're not aware of really what exactly that is. Could you just explain what sickle cell disease is? How does somebody get it? And what does it do to you for your life, like during your lifetime?
Sure. So it is an inherited disease, and you would have to inherit a gene from your mother and a gene from your father in order to have it. If you inherit just one gene, you're just a carrier and you don't have symptoms. But if you inherit the two genes, you could have sickle cell disease. So what happens is that red cells that have this mutation within them, under certain conditions like low oxygen tension, they will form a sickled shape. So normally our red cells are flexible, kind of bagel shaped, but so they can twist and move through our vessels well. But these red cells that become a sickled shape or kind of a C shape don't move through our bodies well, and so they get stuck in the small vessels. And because red cells carry oxygen, among other things, through our body, when they get stuck, that part of the tissue is not getting oxygen, and that can cause intense pain, just incredible pain. So people with sickle cell disease live with a lot of pain, and I think that's one of the most defining features of the disease. However, this can cause many other problems like stroke, even in children. You don't hear of stroke in children, but you do with sickle cell disease, and renal failure or kidney failure, and damage to many other parts of the body.
Wow. We're talking to Dr. F. Bernadette West, a regional medical director for the American Red Cross here in Connecticut. And we're talking about sickle cell disease and the importance of blood donation. So I know there's a constant need, Dr. West, for all blood types, but the demand is a lot higher usually for like a type O and B blood. In fact, some ethnic groups have higher frequencies of these blood types, and they play a very key role in ensuring the availability for patients. So could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, type O is called a universal donor, And we need all blood types, O, A, B, or AB. So it doesn't matter what you are. You should feel free to come and donate because somebody will need your blood. And, you know, as we go into fall here, September is National Preparedness Month, and we've had a concerning drop in donations over the summer. And it's important for us to keep a strong blood supply on hand for everyday use and disaster situations. And climate-related disasters have really affected us. And last year, more than 40% of Americans lived in a county that was affected by a climate-related disaster like flooding or wildfire, hurricane, and so forth. And so these events, though it doesn't seem like they might be related, actually make road travel hazardous, cutting off areas, preventing our blood and platelet donors from giving, and cause a lot of blood drive cancellations. And so it takes a few days, you know, from the actual donation until it undergoes all the normal testing and processing until it's available. So it's important to just still get out there and donate. And I know we say this a lot, but blood has a shelf life, just like a lot of other products. And that's why we need it constantly.
And really quick, Dr. West, before I give all the information for people to register to have their blood donated, is this something that you only get at birth, or is it something that you could develop later on in life?
Are you talking about sickle cell disease
in particular? Yep. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Yep.
No problem. This would be something you are born with. And so this is not something you would develop later in life. And that's why sickle cell disease is tested for during the newborn screening that children get at birth in the hospital. And it's important to know your sickle status. And that is one of the things you can find out if you donate blood and if you choose to self-identify as having African descent. We do sickle testing as part of that.
The reason I wanted to reiterate that point is because if you think about it, if you can live with sickle cell disease, it sounds like, but it's something that is painful because you have to do a lot of blood transfusions. And if you think about it, does your lifespan, does it cut at all if you have sickle cell?
Unfortunately, yes. The lifespan is greatly reduced for people with sickle cell disease. It has gotten better, but to be honest, you don't see people living past their 50s many times.
Wow.
And that's better than it was a few years ago, but this is just a devastating disease. Mm-hmm. Blood and other medications, are part of the treatment for it. And the medical community is continuing to work on newer treatments and hoping to be able to cure this disease as a regular treatment in the future.
Well, and to even think, like, if you're born with it, that you're getting transfusions from 0 to 50. I mean, even to think about that just for one person, it screams the need for blood donation. And that's only one type of person who really needs blood donations, as mentioned in the beginning of this, that there's so many needs for blood donations. But just for one person with sickle cell disease, I mean, they could be doing transfusions for 40 or 50 years, and that's only one person. So if you are interested in donating and scheduling an appointment to give, make sure you can either use the free Red Cross Blood Donor app. You could visit redcrossblood.org, or you can call 1-800-RED-CROSS. And I want to thank you again, Dr. West, for coming on and talking about this in length this morning. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Bye-bye. Yeah. And again, that is redcrossblood.org. You can use their app, or of course, you can call 1-800-RED-CROSS. You know, I got to thinking, as we talk about the 988 number, which we've talked about since its inception. In fact, we talked about it when they were planning on rolling this thing out, and some states were kind of like, I don't know. And do we have the resources? You know, we knew here in Connecticut we were going to roll it out. We've been making a very big push to really focus on mental health and, of course, suicide prevention. And in the last couple of years, we've seen both of those things spike, especially among young people. And one of the biggest concerns in all the years I've worked as a reporter, from first responders, police, and, of course, 911 dispatchers, is that those 911 calls did include people who just needed mental health services. And so I thought to myself, all right, well, this thing rolled out in July. It's been almost 2 months, and I'm wondering how things are going. So our amazing intern, Isabella, who, by the way, has only been here like 3 weeks, if that, came to me and said, hey, I would love to get somebody on. And I thought, well, here's the perfect opportunity. So thank you to her. We have JP Shredzinski here, who is a former state rep. You're probably familiar with JP's name. Also a public safety dispatch superintendent for the town of Stratford. So welcome to the show, JP. Thanks for being here. How are you?
Thank you, Melissa, in the morning. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you here. I feel like you and I have crossed paths before, JP, because as soon as I asked for your last name and Isabella told me, I was like, wait a minute, I've interviewed this guy before. I think I have.
Maybe it's very possible, and I would say, based on your pronunciation of my last name, we have definitely met at some point.
I think we have. I think in my News 12 days, I was like, I think it's been a while, but I'm glad to be chatting with you. Yes, I knew right away when I heard the last name, I was like, Shredzinski, yes, I remember talking to this man. So I'm glad to be talking to you again. Thank you
absolutely,
so much.
And thank you for having me on for this important topic.
Yeah, let's talk about the 988 hotline. First of all, before it ever came around, because I don't even know if it's making a difference, that's where you come in. But before it came in, give people a snapshot of what it looked like to be, you know, a dispatcher here in Connecticut and fielding those calls, people who maybe need mental health resources or, you know, are were potentially thinking of taking their own lives. Like, talk to us a little bit about what that looked like.
Sure. So obviously, it's a very difficult situation. As I always tell, I've been in this field for 23 years. And as I always tell new hires or people in the community, no one ever calls 911 to report good news. So when they are at that moment of crisis and they do call us, we have to be prepared to handle anything. It could be anything from what time do the fireworks start, what time is the parade, to I'm thinking of ending my life. And a lot of my staff and a lot of the people that I've worked with have taken all of those calls. So it's difficult. It's a difficult situation. It's also a very delicate situation. In these types of situations, we are highly trained to provide the care and provide the questions. Now, you know, we ask the questions. We want to make sure that the person who is calling is as safe as possible. We want to make sure that the people that are on scene with that person are as safe as possible, if there are children involved, if there are other family members involved. And then we also want to make sure that our first responders are as safe as possible. And what I mean by that is when you have someone who is contemplating taking their own life or in a really bad place mentally, we need to make sure that they're not going to do something to people coming to help them. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, as a 911 dispatcher here in the town of Stratford and in most municipalities, we have the ability to dispatch police, fire, and EMS. And so you're going to get a combination of that depending on what the situation is. So based on the questions we ask, based on the answers we get, we will determine whether or not to send you a police officer, an ambulance, a fire truck, or a combination of all three in order to help the people that are on scene the best we can. So previous to 988, when someone called 911 and they were struggling with their mental health and they had their wherewithal, and we have to remember, you know, many people who take their own life do so without reaching out for help.
Right.
So when someone calls 911 and says, you know, this is my rock bottom and I'm thinking about ending it, we need to acknowledge and respect the fact that they called for help, that they called us and said, I don't know what I'm going to do. Like, this is really, really bad, and it's a bad situation. So it requires a lot of delicate conversation, and it's not a time to judge. It's not a time to question. It's really a time to be compassionate and then get them someone in person that can talk to them and hopefully get them the help that gets them back on the road to recovery.
Yeah, that's a really great point. And I appreciate all of that extensive detail because I don't know if people always realize what the 911 dispatchers go through on a daily basis or even just in their careers. You know, like I loved your analogy of it. We could be telling you what time the fireworks are for the 4th of July, or we could be, you know, trying to kind of walk somebody off a ledge, essentially. So it's really, I'm glad that you took the time to say that, JP. Now, how are we now, 2 months into the 988 hotline that was rolled out here and across the country? Has anything changed?
You know, it takes a while for things to catch on.
Sure.
And I'll give you an example, which is text to 911. This was something that was rolled out years ago. And I would say, anecdotally, we have received very few text to 911 calls, which isn't a bad thing because we always say, you know, call if you can, but text if you can't. So hopefully most people can call. But that's something that, you know, has taken a while to catch on. And I think 988 will also take some time to catch on. I'm glad it's there because it provides the expert help. You know, like I said, our dispatchers are highly trained, but none of my dispatchers are social workers, and none of my dispatchers are therapists. So if someone calls 988 because they're depressed or because, you know, someone is in emotional distress, it's better to talk to someone who can maybe understand them more and spend the time with them to kind of go through what they're going through. Now, I will say, I want to make sure your listeners know that if someone is in crisis, if they are talking about taking their own life, if they are talking about taking someone else's life, if they are violent, if they have weapons, if it is a dangerous situation for themselves or others, it's important that you still call 911 because we will send, you know, a police officer, we will send an ambulance to react to that crisis situation. If they call 988 in those situations, then my understanding is the process is that call will be referred to the 911 center for where it is occurring, and that help will go out. Because those situations are different than just an emotional or mental distress or a depression situation. Those are where lives are actually in danger in that moment.
Yeah, that makes sense.
No,
that makes sense.
There's a difference between that. But you know, honestly, you know, since the official rollout of 988 in July, and as you may know, 988 is handled in Connecticut by our 211 service center. You know, we have seen a lot of mental health cases, not just from young people, but from everybody. And it's been, I don't want to blame the pandemic, but I would say that the disruption of literally all of our routines based on the pandemic has really brought out a different type of mental health issue. And I also think that it's a good thing because people are I think that the stigma is somewhat getting relieved a little bit and people are more open to admitting the fact that they're struggling, which is a good thing. But I also think that we're just seeing more of it. And, you know, the help is there, whether it is an emotional distress or whether it is someone in crisis, help is there. And, you know, I've seen firsthand people's lives get completely turned around from where they are suicidal to where they are going and living happy, normal lives.
J.P. Shradzinski is here, Public Safety Dispatch Superintendent for the town of Stratford. And, you know, J.P., something that I thought really resonated with me while you were talking before was the rollout of the 911 texting ability. And you're right, that's been around for a while. But it's funny because if you go into, like, a local bar, for example, a lot of times they'll be in the stalls. They'll say, you know, here's a sign that you can let your bartender know, hey, like, I'm in trouble. I need you to either call police or I need someone to escort me out or whatever. There's always all these sneaky signs or, like, you'll hear the commercials of, you know, this is what I did to let a police officer know that I was in trouble in my own home, a domestic violence incident. You really don't see advertisements about just text 911 because I myself even don't think about that, the ability to just text 911 if I was in a state of emergency and I have to contact someone but I don't want to be heard. Why don't we advertise that better? Do you think we do and people just don't pay attention? Like, what do you think about that?
So I think that the issue became that there was an initial release from the state of Connecticut. You know, DESP is the organization that oversees 911 and statewide emergency telecommunications. And, you know, it comes down to budgeting and PSAs. And we all know that there's PSAs that we hear and it kind of goes in one ear and out the other. It's important. That's why when I go to community areas or I talk to groups, I try to remind them that text to 911 does exist, and it is important that people know how to use it. And I also talk about how to use 911 as well, because, you know, people are used to this technology that you can order a pizza from your phone and Domino's knows exactly where you are. 911 isn't necessarily like that, and it's really, really important when I talk to groups in the community, that people understand that we ask questions that are really important, like where exactly are you? And a good example is if someone calls 911 in Stratford and says, I'm at Dunkin' Donuts. Well, we've got five or six of them, so that doesn't help. You know, we need to know an address, and we are highly trained. We study the geography. All of our dispatchers know the town inside and out, so that if you are at a Dunkin' Donuts, we can ask you what else is around you, and if you tell us it's a Cumberland Farms, then we know which Dunkin' Donuts it is. If they say, well, it's just off of the highway at exit 31, then we know where you are. But, you know, having that location is a really important thing, so with the text to 911, like I said, we always say call if you can because it allows for that conversation like we're having right now, but text if you can't. So if you're in a dangerous situation, if it is a domestic and you don't want the other person to hear you calling, if you are a you know, someone who's been abducted and you're able to text, you can do that, but it's important that you pay attention to the phone, so because we're going to ask questions. If you say, if you text 911 and say, I've been kidnapped, we need to know where you are, what kind of car you're in, where are you headed, who do you know, the person who took you? And those are the kinds of things that are going to help responders find you, and that's what 911 exists for, so that we can provide that communication from the victim to the people that are going to come help you.
Man, J.P. Schrodzinski, I still had so many things I wanted to talk to you about. I need you to come back on the show. Would that be okay?
Anytime, Melissa. You let
okay.
me know.
Because I wanted to talk more about that, even just like trying to help people to better, you know, something that you just talked about was like knowing the information you need to know within that first 30 seconds of being on the phone. Because sometimes I've talked to law enforcement before and they say, you know, the first minute of any 911 call is actually wasted because it's just people freaking out. And if you could somehow, I know it's hard to be calm, but if you could somehow have a plan in place where, you know, I'm calling to give you my name, my address, and like forget what the situation is, like leave that till the end just so that the dispatcher can get the information first. If by some chance you get disconnected or something happens, they have the information there and they're not kind of trying to find a needle in a haystack kind of a thing. So I wanted to talk more about that. Wanted to talk about worker burnout, dispatcher merges. So you got to come back on if that's okay.
Absolutely. You let me know and talk to Isabella. She has my number. We can connect and make sure that we wrap up anything we need to wrap up. Absolutely.
I would love that. That would be great. J.P. Schrodzinski, welcome to the show. So glad that we could have you here, and I look forward to talking to you again really soon.
Thank you, Melissa. Have a good week.
Thank you. You too.
Connecting commerce to your community. Bridgeport Regional Business Council President and CEO Dan Onofrio is on the Lissa in the Morning on WICC 600.
Oh, my goodness. Dan Onofrio, it is so good to have you back on the air. How are you, friend?
I'm doing great, Melissa. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. There was actually a local story. I hope I'm not kind of throwing you right into this, but there was a local story that I was very excited about, and I spoke very briefly with Howard Safan about it. As you know, obviously, Howard and the team with Live Nation, they put together what is the Hartford Healthcare Amphitheater, a big deal in Bridgeport. And recently he had said he would debate bringing back two theaters that have been in Bridgeport, but kind of, I mean, the inside has been kept up with, but they've really not been active at all since like the 70s. And I thought, wow, what a cool story. What a cool opportunity for Bridgeport if they really were to do something. I wasn't sure if you wanted to comment on it.
Yeah, no, happy to do so. You know, these two theaters right in the north end of downtown there, North Main Street, yeah, they're wonderful assets. They're beautiful buildings, especially the facades. And even, you know, I personally have not been inside them, but I hear that they're gorgeous inside as well.
Yeah, the Majestic and the Poli, for anyone who's just tuning in, because I also have never been there. I've passed them. Oh, my gosh, I've passed them a million times, but I've never gone inside.
Yeah, no, they're gorgeous. And with, you know, you would think with the development that's happening around there, you know, the apartments are going up right across the street on one side, and then across the street in the open lot, there's an RFP out for some new development as well. So, yeah, that whole area is starting to see some investment, some action. So, you know, theoretically, you'd love to see those theaters back in the, you know, in business. That said, though, Melissa, you know, it's a lot easier said than done. You know, the economics around bringing back theaters like that, you know, these old assets, it's going to take an effort. You know, I don't think I think Howard's correct in the article that was presented that, you know, it will take some city, state, and perhaps other type of collaboration investment dollars to make that work. Now, also, you know, the long-term sustainability of facilities like that, you know, we've got some existing great venues for shows and theaters. So how sustainable is it to bring online another set of theaters? I don't know how sustainable that is from an economics perspective. But that said, hey, you know, maybe there's another use for these buildings. I don't think we want to tear them down, you know, or at worst case, you know, maybe, you know, we keep the facades in some way and rehabilitate and repurpose the buildings for some other use. So I think it's premature to say, yes, you know, we're going to do this. But are they assets for the city? Absolutely. I think, you know, as people come in off Route 8 there right on North Main Street, and so it's one of the first buildings you see. So it'd be great to see those buildings back in use.
Yeah, I mean, it is a good question, Dan, which is, you know, because I think the thing that Howard was saying in that article was like, no, these shouldn't be demolished. I mean, that would be such a waste, especially because the city has tried. I mean, it's failed a lot, but it's tried to renovate and reopen the venues, but hasn't been able to do so. But it would be a waste to just, you know, get rid of these two buildings, especially with the history behind it and really how much it's been kept up with on the inside of both. There's got to be some potential there, but there is, of course, question like, will it even, after you invest all that money, will it succeed? Like with the amphitheater, you know, there was certainly a lot of risk. I mean, Howard has mentioned on this show several times, look, I went way over budget with the amphitheater, but they've made it back tenfold. I mean, I think they knew when they put in an amphitheater that this was going to be a big deal. And they had the connection with Live Nation that they knew they'd get good acts that would make them back the money that they spent. So there was a little bit of like cushion guarantee there that it was going to do well. But who's to say that the same would happen with these theaters? It's a totally different venue, a different feel, probably different kind of an audience that you would attract there. So it would be a challenge. And just to clarify for people, according to at least Hearst Media, Howard Zaffan did not directly say like, I'm going to take this on. I'm going to take this under my wing. He just said it would be a waste to kind of let this fall by the wayside. So
it would be.
Yeah.
And I think most people agree with that statement. It's just, it always comes down to the economics and how sustainable is it. You know, we look at the Majestic Theater up in Waterbury. It's gorgeous, but they spent millions of dollars to rehabilitate that facility. And I know it costs the state, you know, I don't know the exact number, but probably pushing $1 million a year just to keep the lights on there. And they have all volunteers that operate that facility.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's easy to say, yeah, you know, we should do this and spend up some money on that. But, you know, the sustainability of it, you know, one, to refurbish it to get it just in use again is going to be, I think, a Herculean effort. And then two, how do you sustain it? Is it possible? Absolutely. With the right partners, you know, anything's possible. But it will take some significant dollars and I think a significant amount of collaboration from a variety of folks to make it happen.
So Dan Onofrio is here of the Bridgeport Regional Business Council, and we're so glad to have him back on. You know, Dan, I'm no business person. I mean, I host a radio show. That's what I do for a living. But, you know, if I were to come up with a different idea for the theaters, and I don't know if this goes, I always go to you because I'm always like, all right, Dan, I'm putting it in with somebody who's important with the business in the city. Honestly, I would almost use those venues as not theaters. So I'd use them as like historical sites, like other, for example, across Connecticut, like you have banks and maybe some other places that used to be either homesteads or museums or whatever. And people now use them as venues, like they use them for business venues and weddings and hosting them for like using them as hosting sites. Like, could you imagine getting married in an old theater that's, you know, that has been around for a really, I mean, that would be so neat. And I feel like, you know, because they've kept up with the inside of it, it's almost like this hole in the wall. You pass by and you're like, oh, it's kind of defunct. But you go inside and it's this amazing, shocking, you know, discovery of, wow, this is really a beautiful site. It would be kind of cool if you could use the site, maybe not as a music venue, but you could repurpose it into something else with what we have there. I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you see these things across the country. I was in Scranton a couple of years ago and very similar situation. They had a theater that they repurposed into this old hotel and, preserve the history, you know, and, you know, to be able to preserve the history because Bridgeport has a great history, you know, even outside of the theaters. So just to have that, you know, have a facility like that people can can, whether it's an event or a tour or whatever it may be, just to know that they're there, it just adds value to living and working and visiting the city. So, yeah, you know, I think it's possible. Like I said, I hope the dialogue continues, and I hope some real partners come to the table and see what, you know, what may be possible for those sites.
I'm going to tell you right now, and I know I'm going to be held to it, because if like 20 years down the road, they're like, we did it, Melissa. But I will say on the air, if you were to keep these theaters in place and you were to say, hey, we are going to use them for some kind of venue, I would renew my vows there. I would do it. I would talk to my husband right now after the show, and I'd be like, listen, if they bring these places back and they do something, I will renew my vows there, and all the listeners, you're all invited. You all can come. I think that'd be very cool. So there you go. I'm making a promise.
It would be,
right? Okay, it'd be so beautiful. Right,
make sure everyone mark your calendars. Today is, what, the 14th. Melissa's going on record.
Exactly. And, Dan, you better be there. You better be there. You're invited, obviously.
I'll be there.
Okay, good.
If I'm invited, I'll be there.
Good. I hope so. Dan Onofrio, so glad to have you back on the show. We have missed you. Thank you so much, and we'll check back in next week.
Excellent, Melissa. Good to hear your voice. Take care.
All right. Talk to you soon. That is Dan Onofrio here on WICC.
It's time to get out and explore. Melissa in the Morning brings you science you may not know on Southern Connecticut's news and information leader, WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Oh, my four-year-old would love today's science you may not know. We're talking about the shape of a T-Rex skull eye socket and how it helped it have like a strong bite. I'm telling you, David, this is a perfect segment for Chase. Good morning. What are we talking about?
Yeah, no. So, you know, when we look at, you know, all of the different types of dinosaurs, you mm-hmm. know, we can kind of put them into like two main categories. You know, you've got the meat-eating dinosaurs, and then you've got your plant-eating dinosaurs.
Sure, of course.
Yeah, so that's pretty simple. But, you know, one of the things that's really amazing is that, you know, that these meat-eating and plant-eating dinosaurs, if you look at their skull, because that's where their mouth is, that's how they eat things, you know, they have different adaptations for them to be able to, you know, eat meat or eat and digest plants.
Sure.
But one of the things that's really cool, though, is that, you know, that when we look at the meat eaters specifically, you start to see little tiny details that tell you, okay, this animal was really capable of chomping down on meat.
Mm-hmm.
Like it had the capability to really do some serious damage in its bite.
Oh, yeah,
and,
aggressive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really aggressive. Yeah. So things like, you know, you start seeing over time as the meat eaters begin to evolve, their heads start to get bigger.
You know?
And that's to accommodate these giant muscles so that they can actually bite and chomp and crush bone.
So that's really it's really intense. It's like I said, if you have any kids or grandkids who love dinosaurs, they're going to be like, turn this up. This is what I've been waiting for.
This is really important.
Yeah, right. They're like, this is the most important news you're going to hear today, mom and dad. But it's true. And when you think about like the T-Rex, you know, I got a big head and little arms. This is why they've got the big heads, is for the muscles. That makes sense.
Exactly. Yeah. But then you start looking at another detail, and this is something that was recently studied by paleontologists out mm-hmm. at the University of Birmingham in England, and what he was studying was actually the eye sockets. You know, like so if you look at the skull of a human, you know, we have eye sockets for our round and spherically shaped eyes, and
right.
The eye socket is round. You know, so that's just kind of how the eye socket is shaped. Then he started looking at the eye sockets of all these dinosaurs. So he studied about 400 dinosaurs.
Jeez.
And what he found was that when he looked at the eye sockets of these dinosaurs, you know, the eye socket shape for the meat-eating dinosaurs, primarily the meat-eating dinosaurs, was totally different.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't round at all.
No, they're like really big.
Yeah. And so for the big eye sockets, those tended to be for the plant eaters, and the rounded shape mostly for plant eaters. But when you got to the meat eaters, the eye sockets actually accommodated a much smaller eye for some of the dinosaurs. And in fact, when you get to the Tyrannosaurus Rex, the eye socket for, you know, what we think the eye might have been for the Tyrannosaurus, right? That was a little tiny beady eye.
They are. They're little babies. Yeah, there are.
Yeah.
Small beady eyes.
And then the shape was even wilder, too. So it wasn't actually a rounded shaped eye socket. It was actually shape of a keyhole.
Mm.
And then for some dinosaurs, some of the meat eaters, it actually was shaped like kind of like a weird figure eight.
And so, weird. So, why do you think that is?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So the paleontologist asked the same question. Why do they have this shape? Why is it a perfectly round to accommodate an eye socket?
Yeah.
That's important. And so what he did was really remarkable. What he did is that he actually created these digital models of these meat-eating dinosaurs with these weird eye sockets. And then what he did was that he brought them over to, you know, people that do, you know, construction and stress analysis and said, okay, this material is bone. It's not concrete or it's not steel.
Right.
And what I want you to do is put stresses on it. And what kind of stresses could a skull have? I mean, what could it do? Well, he wanted the stresses of something like a bite.
Right, like eating something. Sure.
Exactly, yeah. So if you're really biting into something, this animal's really putting stress on the skull, the muscles are pulling on the skull, and it's chomping. What does that do to the eye socket?
Mm.
And he found that the shape of the eye socket actually handled the biting stresses better.
That kind of makes sense. I mean, yeah. If you think about it, like the way it's being manipulated and be able to handle it and not putting pressure on the eye, that makes sense.
Yeah. So that way, you know, you can't have Tyrannosaurus rexes biting into things and the eyeball popping out.
Right.
That would be bad.
I mean, because the way that we eat, first of all, our heads are nothing like a T-Rex, but, you know, when you think about it, like their whole jaw, I feel like takes up their the length of their heads, whereas ours kind of connect to like you'll see like your temples move and stuff, but I don't know. Does it really impact our eye sockets much when we eat anything? And we're certainly not chopping bones or anything.
Exactly. I'm not, you know, maybe I'll eat a chicken, but I'm not going to like, you know, chomp through an alligator.
Right.
Like that.
Exactly.
You know, try to eat an elephant trunk or something, you know.
As I know, David, I've never seen you do that. So
no, I've learned to really kind of moderate myself.
I'm
you know?
So glad. It was weird to go out to dinner with you years ago, but you've gotten a lot better. Yeah, sure.
I know. You know, clearly my pathway into evolution would have given me a stronger bite. You know, that kind of thing.
Exactly. But, you know, exactly.
Those beady eyes were something that I had to worry about.
That's interesting, though.
But yeah. So, and I think we chalk this up as like, you know, that these animals had to evolve, and over time the evolution into, say, for example, a T-Rex, which had an incredible bite, the structure of its skull and little tiny details like even the structure of its eye socket were all perfectly adapted so that it could do one really good thing well. That is chomp.
Eat. Yeah. Yep, be able to crush everything that comes inside of them.
Exactly, yeah.
That's amazing. I have to say, David, you know, I always love science, you may not know, but today you just made me a cooler mom for a toddler boy. I've got to be honest.
There you go.
I'm about to go pick up my kid from school after this after the show, and I'm going to make him go, "What? How do you know something I don't?" And I'm going to be like,
"Yeah,
ha!
You know, just throw it out there, you know, in like casual conversation. You know, the eye socket of a T-Rex was actually designed to handle the stresses of a bone-crushing bite."
I mean, you think I'm joking, David, but most days whenever I talk to my son and he's like, "How was work, Mom?" and I start to talk about something, like, I've lost him. I've totally lost him, because there's nothing a four-year-old that I talk about on the show is interested in. But you just cracked the code there, my friend. Talk about dinosaurs, and now I'm the coolest mom today.
Yeah, that's right. We're doing WICC is doing a public service for every mom out there that has a four-year-old son that's into dinosaurs.
You know what? Which is almost all of them.
Or a four-year-old girl that's into dinosaurs, too.
I was
going
to say.
You know, they're out there.
The girls like the dinosaurs, too. I mean, they're pretty likable.
Right.
I like a good dinosaur still at 32 years old. So, I mean.
Yeah, I heard of a girl that only communicates in dinosaur grunts. That's how.
Wait, who told you I do that? Why did you?
Oh, no, okay.
David Mestre, we have way too much fun, but I love it. I'm so glad you're here. Science You May Not Know every Wednesday morning here on WICC. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. T-Rex's rule.
Rawr. I'll talk to you soon. That's David Mestre, of course. Science You May Not Know here on WICC.